Welcome to the Federalist Society's Practice Group podcast. The following podcast, hosted by the Federalist Society's Criminal Law Practice Group, was recorded on July 9, 2012, during a live telephone conference call held exclusively for Federalist Society members. Welcome to the Federalist Society's Practice Group telephone conference call on FISA warrants. I'm Dean Reuter, Vice President and Director of Practice Groups at the Federalist Society. As always, please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the experts on today's call. Also, this call is being recorded for use as a podcast in the future. Today, we have two experts to educate us on FISA and FISA warrants. Each is going to speak for about 6 to 8 minutes, after which we'll have some discussion and then questions from the audience. Alexander Abdo is a staff attorney in the ACLU's National Security Project, where he has been involved in the litigation of cases concerning the Patriot Act, the International Emergency Economic Powers Act, and the treatment of detainees. He's a graduate of Yale University and Harvard Law School, and he clerked for Judge Lynn in the Northern District of Texas and Judge Barquette of the 11th Circuit. Ken Weinstein is a partner at Cadwallader, Wickersham, and Taft Law Firm, where he focuses his practice on corporate internal investigations and civil and criminal enforcement proceedings. He has 20 years of public service as Homeland Security Advisor to President George W. Bush, as the first Assistant Attorney General for National Security, U.S. Attorney for Washington, D.C., General Counsel for the FBI, and then Chief of Staff to the FBI Director. Their full bios have been provided to you in the announcement with this for this call, so I'm not going to go into any further detail on their bios. But with that, Mr. Abdo, please go right ahead with your opening remarks.
Thank you, Dean, and I just want to thank the Federalist Society for having me on. It's a pleasure to be here. Before getting into FISA specifically, I want to just take 30 seconds to explain why I think it's so important that this conversation is happening and why generally I think more debate needs to happen around the issue of privacy and surveillance. And it's really for a couple of reasons. It's never been easier in the history of our country for the government to acquire, archive, and analyze as much information about any individual in the country as it can today. There are numerous surveillance authorities that allow the government to intrude upon communication and conduct in an unprecedented manner. And of course, it's not a new phenomenon for the government to claim new and seek expansive authority to surveil in times of declared emergency, but there have been at least three changes in the last 10 years that make existing and new surveillance powers uniquely intrusive and make it, I think, especially important that we're having this conversation today. The first is the increasing digitization of our lives. Our most intimate thoughts these days are more commonly stored online rather than written down in journals, and online storage is, of course, generally controlled by third parties. The second is technological advances in surveillance. There is now little digital information beyond the technological capabilities of the government. And the third and perhaps most important reason that this conversation is particularly important is that the cost of storage has reached historic low points such that it is no longer prohibitive. It used to be that difficulty in surveillance and the cost of storage of information was one of the protections or bulwarks against pervasive government surveillance, and that's no longer the case. Just to give you a couple of examples from a recent Brookings Institute paper that discussed how cheap storage is these days. The government can store, or what it would cost for the government to store the GPS location within 15 feet for 1 million people at 5-minute intervals every single day of a single year would be $50. That's 50. Or if the government wanted to store all audio of a single person's phone calls for an entire year, that costs 17 cents, and that number would decrease to 2 cents by 2015 as storage costs continue to drop. So those are a few of the reasons why I think this conversation is particularly important. And today, of course, we're going to focus on one of the ways that the government can acquire information that it can then put into its storage facilities, and that's FISA. So FISA is the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act. It was passed in 1978 by Congress. It authorizes the interception of communications for foreign intelligence purposes where one end of the line is in the United States. It requires the government to get a warrant from the FISA court before it can engage in surveillance. And in seeking that warrant, the government has to demonstrate probable cause that the target of its intercept is a foreign power or an agent of a foreign power. Initially, the government was required also to state that its purpose, which some courts had interpreted as its primary purpose, be the acquisition of foreign intelligence information. Nowadays, the purpose, only a significant purpose needs to be acquisition of foreign intelligence purpose, of foreign intelligence or from information. The government can, in fact, have as its main purpose, you know, law enforcement purposes, so long as a significant purpose is foreign intelligence. Foreign intelligence was in 1978 and still is defined very broadly to include even information related to foreign affairs. It's important just to note that there's no requirement, in other words, that foreign intelligence information pertain to unlawful or illegal activities. It doesn't have to be about terrorism or even less serious threats. It just needs to be foreign intelligence. After September 11, 2001, President Bush authorized the National Security Agency essentially to ignore FISA for one end domestic communications, so communications where one end was in the United States, where government agents had reason to believe that the target of the surveillance was an al-Qaeda agent or an agent of an al-Qaeda affiliate. It effectively authorized warrantless wiretapping. The NSA official did not need to seek judicial review, didn't have to get a warrant beforehand, and didn't have to explain their actions afterward to any court. It operated in this manner for several years. At one point, the administration announced that the FISA court had taken over supervision of some of the program, but the details of what exactly occurred are still very much secret. Eventually, the warrantless wiretapping program was exposed, and Congress replaced it with new statutory authority that actually in some ways expanded the warrantless wiretapping program. An interim bill was passed in 2007, known as the Protect America Act, and in 2008, Congress passed the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act Amendments Act, so the FISA Amendments Act, or the FAA. And that's, I think, what we're going to focus on mostly today. The FAA was a revolutionary new authority for the government to acquire en masse the international communications of Americans without individualized judicial oversight or supervision, without the normal warrant and probable cause requirements, without the government identifying its targets to a court, without the government identifying even the phone lines, email addresses, or locations it intended to monitor, and without indicating that any wrongdoing had occurred or was about to occur in its decision whether to engage in the surveillance. So the way the way it actually worked in practice is that the Attorney General and the Director of National Intelligence would apply to the FISA court for one of these mass acquisition programs under the FAA, and they would seek a year-long authorization to engage in the surveillance, but they wouldn't identify the targets of the surveillance to the court. They would just certify, or they would ask the court to certify, rather, its targeting and minimization procedures, which are essentially broad guidelines the government would commit to abide by in selecting its target and in minimizing accidental interception of Americans' communications. But it's important to realize that the targeting procedures didn't actually require the government to identify its targets. They could be, for example, as broad as the government stating its desire to acquire all communications between Afghanistan and the United States. And it's important to realize that the minimization procedures weren't particularly meaningful when it came to Americans' communications because they contain a very large exemption for foreign intelligence information. In other words, even if the government accidentally intercepts Americans' communications under the FAA, it need not delete those communications from its storage if the information is foreign intelligence information, and as I mentioned earlier, foreign intelligence is defined extremely broadly to include a number of things. And of course, nothing in the FAA precluded the government from compiling databases of the information it collects and later searching those databases for information about U.S. citizens and residents. This is a loophole that several senators have recently pointed out and have sought more information about. But surprisingly, the Director of National Intelligence has responded to the request for more information by stating that it's not reasonably feasible for them to estimate how many communications of Americans or how many Americans were targeted accidentally or whose communications were swept up in FAA surveillance. For all of these reasons, the ACLU in 2008 challenged the constitutionality of the FAA. And we challenge it on behalf of a number of human rights workers, journalists, lawyers, and others whose work requires them to exchange foreign intelligence information with foreign individuals. In other words, individuals who communicate with likely targets of FAA surveillance. The current status of the case is before the Supreme Court on the question of standing, whether our clients have standing to challenge the FAA. No court has yet ruled on the merits of our challenge. But no matter how one feels about the constitutionality of the statute or the merits of that debate, I think one aspect of the current litigation and the government's response to our lawsuit should trouble everyone. And that is that the government has argued that our plaintiffs don't have standing to sue because they can't prove that their communications have been or will be monitored. And that's a catch-22, of course, because the government refuses categorically to disclose the targets of its FAA surveillance. And it's troubling because the consequences of accepting the government's argument is to effectively preclude meaningful judicial review of the FAA. Because if our plaintiffs don't have standing, it is difficult to imagine who would. To be fair, the government has argued that the FAA might be tested in a criminal case, but there are a number of reasons to think that'll never happen. We can go into those if the conversation goes in that direction. But suffice it to say that in the 4 years since the FAA was enacted, there has not been a single instance, to our knowledge, of the government relying upon FAA surveillance in a criminal case. So I think I'll leave it there, having given the broad outlines of FISA, the FISA Amendments Act, and our concerns with it. And I look forward to our conversation, Ken. And now this is Ken who will be proceeding.
Okay. Thanks very much, Alex. This is Ken Weinstein. And I also want to thank Federalist Society for putting this on. Very topical discussion, and I appreciate you including me in it. I spent a good bit of time testifying a few years back in the run-up to the passage of this statute, the FAA, the FISA Amendments Act, and in fact just was testifying a couple weeks ago because it's up for reauthorization at the end of this year, and so they're now starting a round of hearings to look back at how it's done for the last 4 years, whether there have been abuses, this kind of thing. In anticipation of a vote as to whether we authorize it. And I agree with Alex, it's a good discussion to have, and I think we need to sort of continue to have constant dialogue and debate about the privacy implications as well as the need for these investigative techniques, because, you know, I was advocating that we had a strong need when I was testifying in the government back in 2007, 2008, and it was very important to have folks like Alex at the hearing table saying, yeah, but keep in mind the privacy implications. And I think that actually produced a good, solid bill. So what I thought I'd do is I'd just start as my jumping off point, the Clapper versus Amnesty International, the case that Alex just described, that's now before the Supreme Court on a standing issue. And I'll sort of get to the standing issue at the end, but in order to sort of understand the standing issue as well as the merits of the challenge that was lodged, I believe, the day that the statute was enacted. I think it's important to sort of understand the historical backdrop of the FISA Amendments Act, why it was so important. So let me just give a little sort of history lesson on that, at least from my perspective. Keeping in mind that, you know, historically, foreign intelligence surveillance and wiretapping was deemed to be within the executive's authority, even after CATS was decided in 1967. Saying that for criminal purposes, you needed to get a warrant before you did the government conducted wiretaps. That there still was a carve out in that decision for foreign intelligence wiretapping. Same when Title III was passed in 1968, the next year, laying out the procedure by which prosecutors have to go to a judge in order to get a criminal law enforcement wiretap, in other words, a wiretap for the purposes of developing evidence for a criminal trial. In that legislation made clear that procedure did not apply to foreign intelligence surveillances. And it wasn't until after the exposés from the Church Committee and the Pike Committee hearings in the mid-70s that showed that the intelligence community had committed some pretty flagrant abuses, some of which were using their national security surveillance authorities, that developed had a steam for some legislation, which then passed in 1978, which was the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act that Alex has described to you, Bottom line is FISA was passed to require court approval prior to surveillance that was directed at people within the United States. It was designed from the beginning only to cover a portion of the electronic surveillance that the federal government does throughout the world. In other words, it wasn't intended to provide to impose a court approval requirement on every surveillance conducted anywhere in the world. And it's quite public that, especially since World War II, we've had a pretty vast effort to conduct electronic surveillance against adversaries and others around the world, most of which it would not be covered by FISA. FISA was intended to just focus on those surveillances directed within the United States. The unfortunate thing about FISA is that trying to define that category of surveillances that would be subject to a court approval requirement, the Congress used the technology of the day to describe which surveillances needed to go to the court. In other words, they talked about radio communications or wire communications because they were sort of referencing the fact that most local communications were by wire, just by regular, handheld telephones, and international communications, those which were going to be less likely to be subject to the FISA court approval requirement, would be by radio, and so they made it less. They lowered the requirements for going to the FISA court for those radio or satellite communications. Anyway, the bottom line is they by framing the legislation based on the technology of the day, that sort of planted the seeds for that statute to become somewhat obsolete or outdated, and that's exactly what happened. Over time, with the growth of the fiber optic cable network around the world, the result was much more of the surveillances that the government wanted to conduct ended up coming within the ambit of FISA, and therefore requiring the government to go to the FISA court in order to get approval. That became particularly unworkable after 9/11, when there was a real imperative to expand the scope of surveillance, and that resulted in part in the president's decision to, as Alex said, to conduct a warrantless surveillance program. But that's also the reason why the administration went to the Congress, got the Protect America Act, which is sort of a stopgap measure, and then got the FISA Amendments Act, which, as Alex explained, allows for programmatic, non-individualized approval to conduct surveillance when you're targeting somebody the government reasonably believes, to be outside the United States. That's the long and short of the change that the FISA Amendments Act brought about. And, of course, that was administration's argument was that brings the application of FISA back to its original intent, which was to only impose a court approval requirement on those interceptions that are directed within the United States. So that's the backdrop. This is the first lawsuit that's gotten to this point, so we haven't had challenges to the FAA to date. But in terms of talking about the legality and constitutionality of FAA, we can look at some of the past decisions. There's one, Verdugo-Quidez, which makes it clear that non-U.S. persons outside the United States have no Fourth Amendment right to challenge a search. But the question here, as Alex has pointed out, is whether U.S. persons or anybody in the U.S. who gets surveilled under the FAA would have a basis for a Fourth Amendment challenge. And the plaintiffs here all claim that they do, in fact, have a basis for a challenge because they are talking to people who might well be subject to the FAA surveillance techniques. In terms of the merits, there have been two different FISA court opinions that have given guidance on this. I'm sorry, FISA Court of Review, which is the appellate court over the FISA court. And the one case in particular that has focused on this is In Re Directives 2008. And it addressed a Fourth Amendment challenge to the Protect America Act, which was the stopgap precursor to the FISA Amendments Act, and was basically a similar scheme that allowed for this programmatic kind of surveillance. And as a Fourth Amendment challenge, they looked at both the warrant requirement and the reasonableness requirement and essentially found that even though there was no warrant for each surveillance, because this is a programmatic form of surveillance, No warrant was needed because there's a foreign intelligence exception to the warrant requirement. And they analogize to the special needs cases where courts have found that you don't need to go get a warrant for doing, you know, drunk driving checkpoints or drug tests of railroad workers and the like. They found that foreign intelligence collection was similar to those kind of efforts in that they go beyond law enforcement. They're not undertaken for purposes of law enforcement. This is for purposes of developing foreign intelligence as opposed to developing evidence and finding that if you were to impose a warrant requirement on that effort, it would be quite disruptive, which it obviously would be for foreign intelligence purposes, as I just laid out, just as it would be for requiring police officers to go get a warrant before stopping at a checkpoint. The FISA Court Review also found that the Protect America Act was reasonable. Obviously, we found that the government has a very strong interest in protecting national security, and then also found that the Protect America Act had sufficient safeguards and limitations to satisfy the reasonableness requirement. And that finding is directly applicable to the FISA Amendments Act, which, as I said, is a very similar scheme to the Protect America Act. So if you were to take the guidance of that case, and this is, of course, getting to the merits, which we're not at yet, we're only at the standing stage, but if you get to the merits, the argument would be that there is a foreign intelligence exception to the warrant requirement, so that this programmatic program is permissible in spite of the warrant requirement, and it's reasonable because of all the limitations and safeguards in place. Just lastly, just to round out on the standing issue, it's all been briefed quite well by both sides. Bottom line is the question is whether these plaintiffs actually have an injury in fact, their fear of being surveilled. The question is whether that's a real injury that's sufficient to establish standing or not. They obviously say that is sufficient. The government has said that no, that injury is speculative, and that it's not really the result of the government. It's the result of basically a self-inflicted concern on the part of the plaintiffs. And most importantly, the government has pointed out that even if, and this is the third prong of standing, which is the redressability, even if the court were in a position to redress that injury, i.e. by striking down the FISA Amendments Act, that wouldn't necessarily address their concern because, as I pointed out, FISA and the FISA Amendments Act is only one small portion of a broader surveillance effort, and there are surveillance is being conducted overseas without any involvement of the court, which is just the way the system's designed, and I think the way most people expect it to be done. So the plaintiffs would not necessarily be able to say that their court action here would redress their concerns. Anyway, let me just wind up by saying, well, this is just a standing issue. The stakes are high because if resolved in favor of the plaintiffs, this could allow for a challenge to what is a tremendously important surveillance program, especially in the counterterrorism area. If standing is found in this case, it could lead both in this case and in similar cases in the future to disclosure of sensitive information about this program and other kind of programs like this. It could lead to more invocation of the state secrets privilege, which hasn't happened here, but could happen and likely would happen if this kind of case, or the injuries pled here are found to be sufficient for standing. And then obviously it'll have very significant separation of powers implications because it would mean that the court in this case and in other similar cases might well take a much more active role in the policymaking decisions about what kind of authorities we should have in the foreign intelligence context, as opposed to allowing those decisions to be made by the elected branches. So that is sort of rounds it out in terms of where I think this case fits and the stakes that we're facing. So back to you, Dean.
Thank you very much. I do want to open the floor to questions, but before we do that, let's give Alex Abdo a chance to respond to what he heard from Ken Weinstein. Alex?
Thanks, Dean, and thanks, Ken. Just a couple of quick points. I think Ken and I agree on a lot of things, but just a couple areas in which we disagree. One is Ken mentioned that one of the purposes of the FISA Amendments Act was to, I guess, provide a technological fix to the change in technology that had occurred since original FISA was passed. And I think if that were true, Congress would have passed a very different bill than they passed in 2008. they could have passed a very simple bill that would have made clear that foreign-to-foreign communications that happen to pass through the United States because of the new routing technology did not, in fact, require a FISA warrant to tap. And they could have made that a very simple bill and made that fixed. Instead, they passed, I think, what is fairly characterized as the most sweeping surveillance law that Congress has ever passed, allowing programmatic surveillance of Americans' international communications, not just of foreign-to-foreign communications. A second quick point has to deal with in-re directives, and I think it's important to point out as an initial matter that the Supreme Court has never actually recognized a foreign intelligence exception to the Fourth Amendment. They've only ever dealt with domestic security surveillance in a famous case called United States versus U.S. District Court, or Keith. And in that case, they said that domestic surveillance is not, or domestic security surveillance is not exempt from the Fourth Amendment, and that if Congress wants the executive to engage in that kind of surveillance, and the Attorney General had previously been engaging in that surveillance without congressional authority, then Congress needs to pass a bill. And there's a bit of a disjunct between what the Supreme Court said there and what Congress ultimately did, because they ultimately passed FISA. And FISA didn't, in fact, deal with domestic security surveillance. It dealt with foreign intelligence surveillance. So take from that what you will. But the Supreme Court hasn't yet addressed that question. There's a problem with saying that with kind of carving off foreign intelligence from the Fourth Amendment. One of the main problems is that there's no longer a very clean barrier between foreign intelligence surveillance and domestic surveillance. That's true in FISA itself, where the Congress has several times now weakened the barrier between the two by lessening the purpose standard. It used to be that the primary purpose of FISA surveillance had to be foreign intelligence. Now only a significant purpose has to be foreign intelligence. The primary purpose could be the law enforcement motivation that has always been subject to the Fourth Amendment, and not the foreign intelligence purpose that a number of people, including Ken, argue are outside of the protection of the Fourth Amendment. And just a final point about judicial adjudication of this case, Clapper versus Amnesty. I don't think it would involve any state secrets problems. We both moved for summary judgment in the district court. The government didn't try to submit any evidence on summary judgment. We didn't seek any discovery from the government, so there was never an opportunity for state secrets to be invoked. And I don't know how it could be invoked in that posture if we were to resume litigation in the district court on the merits. But perhaps more importantly, on Ken's separation of powers note, I think when it comes to individual rights, the Supreme Court has been quite clear in the past decade that all three branches emphatically have a role to play. And that's no less true of the Fourth Amendment rights of Americans, even in their international communications, and notwithstanding the claim by the government that important interests are at stake. The court can always take into account those, obviously significant interests of the government when it crafts the right standard for reviewing government conduct and for later, patrolling the lines. But I don't think the right answer is to just carve out the judiciary entirely.
Okay. Ken Weinstein, do you want to take a minute or two to respond now?
Just very briefly, this is Ken. I guess what we have to understand is that the question here is whether these plaintiffs who are concerned that they're going to get captured on by surveillance of individuals overseas, that's their concern, that their conversation is going to get captured by when they call their clients or others who are overseas. Got to keep in mind one thing. This is not the first time this happens. In fact, if you get a warrant as a prosecutor, a Title III warrant under the rules of criminal procedure, and then you go up on a defendant or a suspect here in the United States with a valid court order, you're capturing not only his conversations, but everybody he or she talks to. Similarly, if the NSA is doing overseas surveillance that doesn't fall within FISA or the FISA Amendments Act, and they're surveilling somebody over in whatever country you want, in Indonesia or China or whatever, and they surveil that person happens to call someone in the U.S., then the NSA is going to get the conversation of that person overseas as well as the conversation of the person in the United States. So I think it's important to just keep that in mind, because that's something that's been accepted, i.e. that being that, you run the risk that you might be on the phone or might be on the email with, on email with somebody who's being surveilled legitimately by the federal government.
Let's open the floor to questions. Let's go to our first question.
John Rowland, Constitution.org. We seem to be running a race with technology, which is makes the whole situation akin to a game of whack-a-mole. No sooner do we find one way to try to protect privacy than the government finds a workaround. And are we headed toward a time when the only privacy we can hope to achieve is by our own individual efforts of surrounding ourselves with walls of encryption and that even the government can't penetrate? You know, what is the future of privacy?
Who wants to respond to that?
This is Alex. I can start off, Dean. That's a fascinating question and a great question. You know, it used to be that most protection, privacy protection in America came from either simple anonymity or the prohibitive cost of surveillance. And both of those protections have in some way fallen in the new technological era. It's very, very difficult to remain anonymous, and it's even more difficult to avoid putting information in such a way that it's technologically capable for the government to surveil for marginal cost. You know, encryption is one possibility in the future, although if history has taught us anything about encryption, it's that eventually encryption fails and it's of unclear benefit in the interim. You also risk attracting more attention, you know, warranted or not, by encrypting all of your communications, you know, because officials think rightly or wrongly that if you're hiding something, maybe you have something to hide. So, you know, I don't think the right way forward is for, you know, self-help entirely. I think it we just have to ensure that courts play the role they've historically played when it has come to protecting privacy. And that's an active one, although restrained in certain areas, and it would certainly be more restrained than it would ordinarily in the foreign intelligence context. But again, I think courts are part of the answer, and it's not just a matter of self-help.
Ken Weinstein?
Yeah, I guess just a couple of points there. Very good observation. I agree with Alex that courts are part of the answer, but not all the answer. And the courts shouldn't be involved, you know, every time there's a privacy question implicated by the government's investigative efforts. I mean, you have to keep in mind that, and this is sort of to kind of support the government's efforts to, you know, to deal with the increasing digitization of information. Whenever, as technology progresses, which allows, yes, greater insight into people's private spheres, that technology also allows for greater ease of communication around the world so that our adversaries are taking advantage of that technology as well. So while back in, you know, the revolution, was it Nathan Hale or Major Andre had the notes in his boot that got, you know, when they got intercepted and they got hanged, you know, these days it's an email from a cave in Afghanistan to an operative somewhere else in the world telling them to go forward with the mission. And so that our adversaries are taking advantage of that technology just as much as our counterterrorism operators are trying to take advantage of that technology to divine what it is that our adversaries are doing before they actually inflict harm on us.
I might ask a follow-up. What about the use of third parties to gather information that is then used by our own agencies, using either, for example, private organizations or perhaps other governments, prisons surveilling our people and we surveilling them and trading the information?
This is Alex, and I think that's a loophole that the courts will eventually fix. There's been a, you know, what's called a third-party doctrine for a long time in this country, where if you, under the Fourth Amendment, give information to a third party, you no longer have a reasonable expectation of privacy in that information, and so it's not even a search for constitutional purposes for the government to acquire that information from the third party. Nowadays, virtually all of our emails and a lot of our online correspondence is stored on the servers of third parties. And the government has taken the position, and it certainly has refused to clarify otherwise since the Supreme Court's recent decision in U.S. versus Jones, that It doesn't need a warrant to acquire that information, even if that information is an email. And I think that's just a loophole. Justice Sotomayor alluded to what will hopefully be the demise of that problem, at least in the technological context. But it is certainly a loophole now. There are, of course, other types of information sharing. I'm referring mainly to, you know, storage on third-party servers. You might be thinking more of, you know, trading information with other countries and third-party surveillance that way. I think that likely presents a different set of problems, but at least insofar as we're talking about usage of companies, the problem is a significant one, but hopefully one that the courts will address.
We'll go to the next question.
This is Indiana Tim. Would a congressional declaration of war, as distinguished from a somewhat vague resolution, change in any material way the manner in which intelligence operations are conducted under FISA and the Patriot Act? And if not, do either of you find the current peacetime, and I'll put that in quotes, use of FISA and the Patriot Act to be Orwellian, not to mention its potential unconstitutional aspects? My point being that doesn't an originalist view of the Constitution require a clear and unambiguous declaration of war by Congress in order to justify these more obvious impingements of the rights of free speech and expression, and I suppose privacy, if one goes to the penumbra of rights protected by the Constitution?
Alex or Ken?
This is Ken. I'll jump in for a second just to sort of address the Orwellian aspect of it. I mean, I think you're putting your finger on something, which is, you know, up until recently, people's conception of war, I think, and I'm putting this sort of simplistically, but people's conception of war was that you, one nation state squares off against another nation state, and that is something that is quite, you know, that's tailor-made for a declaration of war requirement, and then, you know, a wartime with a beginning and a finite period and an end. I think, especially in the counterterrorism area, and of course, national security includes much more than counterterrorism, but what has been the main focus for the last 11 years has been counterterrorism. I mean, I think people have to recognize that we are in a new reality, that this is, you know, what people have called the long war, that, you know, old paradigms or traditional paradigms of war really don't fit, and that we're in a situation now where we need, because terrorists don't, they're not invading armies that come with warning, but are actually, you know, they insert operatives into our society or develop operatives within our society. Much of the effort is not mounting, you know, a military might to fight on the battlefield, but rather our way of defending ourselves is to investigate within our own communities to find out, you know, who's an Al-Qaeda operative and who's not. And that requires serious investigative scrutiny of within our own society. And I think that new normal is discomforting for everybody, you know, myself included, and it raises serious privacy concerns. But it's not one it's not an aberration. I think it's here to stay, because I think the main kinetic threat that we're going to face for years to come is going to be the possibility of terrorism launched from within.
Alex, do you have a point here?
Sure. This is Alex. I'm fearful that Ken is right, that this new normal is here to stay. And the reason why I'm fearful is that we risk allowing the reduced constitutional protections that might apply in some wartime context to apply all the time. And we risk diluting the protections, in other words, of the Constitution by adopting that framework. And while, you know, terrorism, of course, presents new challenges, one of the difficulties of it in terms of our political and legal debate is that it's difficult to contextualize the threat that terrorism actually poses such that we allow ourselves to dilute these constitutional protections. I don't have a clean answer. I know it's not satisfying to simply say we need to not allow the politics of fear to cow us into defeating ourselves. But part of the response is undoubtedly in that answer. But that's not all the response. I'm not sure fully, but You've definitely identified a problem area, and you know, part of the work of the ACLU is to ensure that we don't risk entrenching the reduced protections of the last 10 years for the next several decades.
Can I still say something?
Go right ahead, caller.
Yeah. Well, it seems to me that even though we have a new reality, we have some very old realities too. And if you'll remember, President Bush's speech immediately after 9/11, or not immediately, within a few days, describing what had happened and his new policy, he said words to the effect that no nation would be allowed to harbor the terrorists or these terrorist groups that were identified, and they would be treated the same as the terrorist groups. Even then, I don't understand why we didn't declare war on nations that harbor such groups. And wouldn't that be the originalist view of the Constitution? And shouldn't that be our new reality?
Either of our experts want to respond there? Okay. At this point, it looks like we have one more question from one more audience member.
Marianne McGrail, an attorney in D.C. This is a question primarily for Ken Weinstein. I'd like to go back to the question posed by Alex earlier with respect to standing. That is, how can plaintiffs in the ACLU suit establish that they are in fact the subjects of surveillance? Isn't there a conundrum there? How would you address that?
Isn't there a what from there?
A conundrum there,
oh,
or a catch-22, as Alex
yeah.
put it.
Yeah, well, keep in mind, they're not that you said subjects of surveillance. Under the FAA, they cannot be the targets of surveillance. The FAA makes it very clear that that the government under that authority can only target people who are reasonably believed to be outside the United States, and non-U.S. persons. It can't be a U.S. person. Even if, you know, the FAA actually passed, they added an additional requirement that hadn't been in FISA before, which said that if a U.S. person is outside the United States, the government can only surveil that person if they go and get a warrant, an order from the FISA court. That had not been in place before, and previously the government could surveil a U.S. person outside the United States just based on the approval of the Attorney General. So that's an important point in sort of thinking about the balance of the FISA Amendments Act. These people, the plaintiffs here, are not the targets. They are the secondary parties, potentially, on communications between them and other persons who are subject to the FAA surveillance authority. So they're no different from, the pizza guy who gets called by the drug dealer who's being wiretapped by the DEA. The pizza guy is going to be captured on the phone just the same way as these folks are if they're in touch with people overseas who are subject to the FAA and being wiretapped. So, and it's never been assumed that the person who is that the pizza guy has standing. In terms of how you'll ever get the FAA challenge to the courts, I did point out that the Protect America Act, which is the predecessor to the FISA Amendments Act, was challenged. It was challenged in the FISA Court of Review, in the FISA Court, and then appealed in the FISA Court of Review by a communications provider who challenged the statute. So there are ways that it could be challenged, and as the government, I think, has explained in its pleadings, one way that it could be challenged is if there comes a time when the surveillance under the FAA captures someone's conversation or someone's email traffic, and then the government decides they want to use that conversation or email traffic as evidence in a criminal case, then the defendant will then be able to move to suppress that evidence, keep it out of his trial based on various grounds, but one of the grounds would be that it was unlawfully collected and the FISA Amendments Act, that the authority provided by the FISA Amendments Act is unconstitutional. So that is the way I think it would probably get before a court. I hope that answers your question.
This is Alex. Can I just say one or two things about Ken's response. Ken has alluded a couple times, I guess, now to what we call the incidental overhear cases, and I just want to spend a minute talking about those, because I think it's a bit misleading to say that U.S. citizens are not the targets of FAA surveillance. It's true that the government has to identify a foreign individual whose communications it will be surveilling, but in reality, the targets of the FAA surveillance are the communications themselves, and I think that's borne out by the incidental overhear cases. But accepting that the communications themselves are the targets, you can't target one person's communications without getting the communications of both people on the line. And so I think it's a bit misleading to say that so long as the U.S. citizen is not the target, the U.S. citizen has, I guess, no recourse. And I think you see that logic in the incidental overhear cases, because the cases are actually, they're not standing cases. They don't say that the individual incidentally overheard has no standing to challenge the constitutionality of their surveillance. What they say is that the warrant that the government has gotten, the Title III warrant that the government has gotten to acquire the communication, satisfies the constitutional obligation of the government, such that there's no substantive constitutional complaint that you can bring. There is a warrant allowing the government to authorize to collect the communication, and so the fact that you were overheard on the conversation doesn't change the analysis. Your constitutional rights have been satisfied by the existence of that warrant. But in the international context with the FAA, there is no equivalent warrant as there is in the incidental overhear cases. There is no judicial supervision as there is in the incidental overhear cases. And so it is, in effect, I think, a form of bootstrapping for the government to claim that because someone abroad has no constitutional rights whatsoever, we can surveil them to whatever extent we want, even if it intrudes upon the privacy rights of American citizens, without then going independently and satisfying the privacy rights of those American citizens. I don't think the Fourth Amendment, in other words, disappears because a foreigner happens to be a party to the communication. And the last point, I guess, is about this criminal case possibility, the possibility that the FAA could be tested in the criminal context. It hasn't yet happened in the 4 years since the FAA was enacted, and I think there's actually a structural reason why it may never happen. And that is because FAA surveillance is likely primarily used to acquire the communications of foreign individuals, even if they happen to be communicating with U.S. individuals. But in any event, the surveillance isn't solely directed at U.S. Individuals. And when the government wants to investigate for the purposes of prosecution, it would normally take whatever FAA surveillance evidence it has and convert that to a traditional FISA warrant so that it can not just acquire the U.S. communications that happen to get caught up in the FAA dragnet, but that so it can target the individual for prosecution. In other words, FAA surveillance can be laundered through FISA surveillance in such a way that it would never actually get presented to an Article III court. I don't have proof of that, but I think given that we're 4 years out and haven't yet seen one of these cases, I think it's likely the case.
Could I jump in on one thing, Dean?
Go right ahead, Ken.
Just as the point about the FAA not having any judicial role and privacy, U.S. persons' privacy interests being implicated, to step back a second, I think there's a narrative being drawn here which isn't exactly accurate. The narrative being that up until whatever it was, June of 2008, when the FAA passed, whatever it was in 2008, that at that point the whole universe of surveillance was covered by one form of court approval requirement or another, either under Title III for the criminal side or under FISA for the foreign intelligence side. And that then FISA Amendments Act came along and that carved out this large area of surveillance, which suddenly was no longer subject to court approval. Keep in mind, that's not the case. The full universe of surveillances includes also the NSA surveillance, you know, surveillance programs we do around the world, which are done, which do not involve the court at all, which are targeted overseas, just like the FAA surveillance is. And if you were to take the logic that's being applied to the FAA surveillances here, i.e. that the possibility that those foreign targets overseas might talk to U.S. persons within the United States requires court involvement, then you would be inserting a court into that broader surveillance, which I believe it's fairly well accepted that that is surveillance that needs to be conducted, has been conducted for generations, and should be done so without interruption by, you know, having to go to the FISA court whenever somebody overseas happens to call someone within the United States. So I think it's important to keep that in mind in looking at the practicalities or the practical aspects of these arguments and whether and why it is that you know, advocates for the FISA Amendments Act don't believe that the fact that, you know, someone who gets a U.S. person within the United States who gets picked up on a valid surveillance overseas should necessarily mean that we have to stop the presses and run to the court.
Dean, can I say just 20, have 20 seconds?
Go right ahead, and then it looks like we have three more questions, but
okay.
Go right ahead, Alex.
Very quickly, this is Alex. Ken, I take your point, but I don't think our argument is that in that context the government would have to obtain a warrant. I think the government would just have to commit in that context. If an American citizen's communications do get captured in the course of that foreign surveillance, the government has to discard that part of the communication or separately seek a warrant to keep just that part of the communication. I don't think the argument made by the ACLU anyway is that all of a sudden all foreign surveillance has to come under the auspices of some court or another, just insofar as American privacy rights are implicated.
Right, and I think the way that's addressed now, the process for addressing those privacy interests is through the minimization process, which requires, I won't get into the details on this, but bottom line is if under FISA or the FISA Amendments Act surveillance, they collect U.S. person information, that information is its collection and retention and dissemination throughout the intelligence community is limited if it relates to U.S. persons. And so the middle ground that we're at right now is the collection happens, it's not discarded, but it's minimized.
And of course, as I said in my opening remarks, the minimization requirements have a very important and large gaping hole, which I think is foreign intelligence information. But I agree with you that points to more robust or points to the need for minimization requirements. We might disagree about whether the current minimization requirements are robust enough.
Okay, three more questions here. See if we can wade through these.
Good afternoon, fellas. Thanks to both of you for taking your time. It's a very thoughtful discussion. I'm a former state court judge in Iowa, and like all of us on the phone here, have a great respect for the Fourth Amendment. Just a broad question. Are we saying that no warrant, I mean, the language says no warrant shall issue without probable cause. Are we saying that basically if you're talking to a foreigner, you'd have no reasonable expectation of privacy? At least is that what Congress is saying, number one? Number two, with regard to the information not being discarded, do we know how long the information is kept, if at all? My guess is they're not telling us, but I wanted to ask that question. And number three, I'll tease you just a little bit. It was Benedict Arnold, not Nathan Hale. Thank you.
Yeah, I couldn't remember. Is it Nathan Hale or Major Andre who had the notes in his boot?
Well, Benedict Arnold was the traitor. Andre was his...
spy, right?
Was his spy, right.
Yeah, yeah. Okay,
up at West Point during the Revolutionary War.
Right, okay. Thanks.
But backing up, is this information ever discarded, or do we know?
Yeah, there are, this is Ken, there are rules for the storage and retention of information, and I won't pretend to, I don't remember what is classified or what isn't classified, and I don't pretend to remember them specifically, but there are very clear rules in terms of what they can keep and for how long, and those rules, of course, are made available to the intelligence committees as well as the FISA court.
This is Alex. My understanding is that publicly there's no reason to believe that once communications are deemed properly captured under the FAA, that the NSA has to discard them. In other words, I think there's no public reason why the NSA would have to discard those communications.
Okay. Let's go to our next question.
This is Roger Candelaria. Thank you very much for excellent discussion. You're kind of getting around to the area of that I wanted to ask about, and you've kind of touched on it. First, in response to the question about the declaration of war. So if I understand your reasoning right, you're saying we're in a new normal, and that requires new methods of spying. So I take it one step further. Does the new spying call for new safeguards? and maybe those safeguards, you could suggest maybe 10 or 15 things that could be added to the statute, maybe about destruction of the excessive, the unused or unusable information collected, or time limits that if it's not used within a year, it's destroyed. But what might be 10 or 15 things that could be added to make the new normal a condition that kind of fits with the traditional American notion of privacy and anonymity?
This is Alex. I think the assumption of your question is absolutely correct, that if we're going to embark upon these or institute these new methods of collection of information, and Ken is right that this is not entirely new. A lot of the surveillance was just happening under different auspices, although the American component of it has been clarified, I suppose, by the FAA. But if we're going to have these new authorities for surveillance, we do need to ensure that privacy protections keep pace with privacy intrusions. And that isn't, of course, to say that all privacy intrusions are bad intrusions. Some are justified, but some are not. And we need to have appropriate mechanisms in place to ensure that the intrusions that are not justified either do not happen or are exposed so that we can fix the problem. And I think right now, one way in which we can improve upon that is to have greater transparency. There's a shocking lack of transparency, I think, when it comes to the FISA Amendments Act. The government creates semi-annual assessment reports of the use of the act, and through the use of the Freedom of Information Act, we were able to acquire three of those reports, but in very, very heavily redacted form. And, you know, one of the phrases that we've seen unredacted in those reports repeatedly is the phrase compliance incidents. But very little is known about those compliance incidents, or at least very little has been publicly described. We don't know how many compliance incidents there are every semi-annual assessment period, but we do know that they recur, that the IGs, the inspectors general, have recommended measures to fix them, but that for some reason they continue to recur despite those the measures that have been recommended. So one way, I think, in which we can improve privacy protections in this new area is to have better transparency. And obviously, certain things can't be made public, but surely more can be made public than has already been made public.
Ken, do you want to weigh in here?
No, thanks. That's fine.
Okay. Looks like we have one more question. We have just about, hopefully, enough time for it. If we can be quick with this last question.
John Rowland, Constitution.org. Let's relate this for a second to the National Defense Authorization Act, which and its famous detention provision. It would seem that even if surveillance information is not used for formal prosecution, that there's still that still opens the way for detention, perhaps as a person of interest or a material witness or for some other reason that amounts to indefinite imprisonment, regardless of what you may call it. And isn't this a another one of the government's workarounds that should be a matter of concern?
Either of our speakers want to tackle that one? Okay. If not, we are out of questions. I'm going to thank all our callers for their thoughtful questions today. And, of course, on behalf of the Federal Society, I want to thank both Ken Weinstein and Alex Abdo for joining us today. We are adjourned. Thank you very much. Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this Practice Group podcast. For materials related to this podcast and other Federalist Society multimedia, please visit the Federalist Society's website at federalistsociety.org/multimedia.